Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is continuing coverage of United States versus Sean Diddy Combs from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
It's not every day you hear a Grammy-nominated artist take the stand in federal court and say, more or less, yeah, my car exploded in my driveway and I think it was revenge. But that's exactly what happened on May 22nd when Scott Mascuti, better known as Kid Cudi, walked into a Manhattan courtroom and calmly unraveled a story that sounded more like a psychological thriller than a witness testimony. Let's back up. The reason Kid Cudi was called to testify in the ongoing federal trial of Sean Diddy Combs wasn't about music. It wasn't about royalties or contracts or hip-hop beef. It was about fire, fear, and the kind of personal warfare you can't chart on a billboard. Cudi took the stand to support the government's argument that Diddy didn't just run an empire. He allegedly ran it through fear and retaliation. And sometimes that retaliation came in the form of literal flames. Back in late 2011, Cudi had been dating Cassie Ventura. Cassie at the time was believed by many, including Cudi himself, to have broken things off with Diddy. According to testimony, she told Cudi they were done, and he believed her. What he didn't realize was that he was stepping into the middle of what prosecutors are now portraying as a deeply coercive relationship, one where Diddy allegedly wasn't letting go, even if Cassie said otherwise. Cudi told the court that sometime during that period he got a call from Cassie, then a second call from someone associated with Combs. Both had a similar message. Diddy knew about the relationship and he wasn't exactly thrilled. Moments later, Cudi learned that Combs had allegedly shown up at his Hollywood Hills home. Cudi rushed back only to find his place ransacked. Christmas gifts he'd bought for family were torn open. His dog was locked in the bathroom. A security camera had been tampered with. No forced entry was reported. But the message was loud and clear. Even if no words were spoken, someone had been there. Someone who wanted him to know they could get in. This wasn't a burglary. It was a statement. What followed didn't look like a simple vendetta. It looked like something straight out of a Cold War psychological operations manual. A few weeks after the break-in, Cudi's Porsche 911 convertible was parked quietly in his driveway when it exploded into flames. The fire wasn't accidental. The roof had been slashed. A Molotov cocktail was reportedly found on the passenger seat. When Cudi got the call from his dog sitter saying the car was on fire, he raced home and saw the charred remains of what had once been his pride and joy. It was torched beyond recognition. And this wasn't just some out-of-control act of destruction. According to prosecutors, it had all the markings of symbolic violence. You date the wrong woman, your house gets hit, your dog is messed with, and then your car, the thing that screams success and freedom in Los Angeles, is turned into a pile of ash. This wasn't about hurting him physically. It was about putting a thought in his head. I can get to you. And I already have. This is where the psychology gets layered. Because if the allegations are true, this wasn't about losing control. It was about asserting it. Robin Dreek, a retired FBI behavioral expert who spent years decoding manipulation and power dynamics in counterintelligence, described this kind of act as something far more calculated. It's not rage, it's not passion, it's strategic fear. It's a performance for an audience of one. Cudi's testimony added weight to something Cassie herself had told the court earlier, that Diddy had allegedly threatened to blow up Cudi's car and that it would happen while Diddy was conveniently out of the country, so there'd be no easy way to tie it back to him. Cootie's car did, in fact, catch fire while Combs was traveling overseas, prosecutors say. And the eerie synchronicity of Cassie's warning and the actual event wasn't lost on the jury or anyone else in the courtroom. But the real kicker came later. Because even after the smoke had cleared and even after the relationship had ended, Cuddy told the court he met with Diddy at a Soho house in Los Angeles. It was one of those clear-the-air meetings people in Hollywood love. No lawyers, no press. Just two men allegedly on opposite sides of a power imbalance having a drink and pretending things were normal. Cootie said Diddy seemed calm. Too calm. According to him, Combs stood with his hands behind his back, like a Marvel supervillain, and when Cootie brought up the Porsche, asking plainly, "What are we going to do about my car?" Combs looked him in the eye and said, "I don't know what you're talking about. Flat, cold, no bluff, no hesitation. Just plausible deniability served straight." "And what do you do with that?" Cootie said he walked away from the encounter more convinced than ever that Combs had orchestrated the fire. Not because he admitted it, but because he didn't need to. That's the thing about psychological warfare. It doesn't require confession. It just needs to leave you unsure, paranoid, off balance. Years later, in a more relaxed setting, again at Soho House, Cootie says Diddy finally apologized. There were no fireworks, no camera crews, just an offhanded, "Hey man, I just want to apologize for everything." Cootie said he appreciated it, said it gave him peace. But the question lingers, was it closure or cleanup? Drake, in his behavioral analysis, pointed out that apologies like that can be weaponized. They can neutralize potential threats, soothe public image, reinforce the illusion of benevolence. Sometimes they're just good PR. Through all of this, what stands out isn't just the testimony itself, it's the way Cootie delivered it. Calm, measured. At one point, he yawned, not because he was bored, but because, as one observer noted, that kind of traumatic memory delivered years later can drain a person in unexpected ways. There was no grandstanding, no tears. Just a man talking about firebombs, break-ins, and veiled threats like he was reading from a script he'd memorized long ago. He wasn't the first to describe this pattern, and he won't be the last. What makes Cootie's story so important isn't just the allegation itself, it's the psychological outline it sketches, a story of boundaries crossed without a word, a retaliation that never needed to be acknowledged to be understood. It fits, prosecutors argue, into a broader narrative of control and retaliation, one that goes far beyond music, beyond celebrity, and into the realm of power dynamics that echo through every corner of this trial. As the court recessed for the day and Kid Cootie left the witness stand, the air in the room was noticeably different. Not because there had been a big reveal, but because something quiet had settled in. Something hard to shake. A sense that this wasn't just about one man and one car and one bad breakup. This was about a system, a method, a mindset. And as the prosecution continued building its case, the next phase of testimony would begin to peel back the layers of that system. Not just how someone like Combs allegedly lashed out at outsiders, but how those closest to him kept the machinery moving. George Kaplan didn't start out thinking he'd be testifying in federal court. In fact, when he first landed the job as Sean Diddy Combs' personal assistant in 2013, he probably thought he'd hit the jackpot. Jet-setting across continents, being in rooms most people only dream of, brushing elbows with celebrities and power brokers. It was, in his own words, like stepping into a world the size of Earth. But on May 22nd, Kaplan sat before a federal jury under immunity, pulled back the curtain, and revealed what it actually meant to serve inside that world. Kaplan wasn't a bitter ex-employee looking to settle a score. He was careful, measured, even nervous. Before his testimony began, he invoked his Fifth Amendment rights. It wasn't until he was granted immunity that he agreed to speak freely. And when he didn't paint a picture of spontaneous outbursts or isolated bad nights. What he described was routine, systematic. His job, as he told it, wasn't just to keep the schedule and fetch the coffee, it was to clean up the messes. Specifically, the ones that happened after what were allegedly referred to as freak-offs. Diddy's term for drug-fueled, sexually explicit encounters that often left hotel rooms trashed and women disoriented. Kaplan testified that he was regularly instructed to dispose of bottles, drugs, baby oil, and other items so hotel staff wouldn't get the wrong idea, or maybe exactly the right one. He said it became a kind of code, a procedure. When the chaos ended, he'd be summoned to erase it. Sanitizing the space was part of the job, not just to protect the image, but to maintain the illusion that everything inside the Diddy machine was functioning as intended. Then came the incident on the private jet. Kaplan described a flight in 2015, midair and unremarkable until it wasn't. According to his testimony, Combs became enraged, picked up a glass of whiskey and smashed it into Cassie Ventura's face. Kaplan said he looked away instinctively as the situation spiraled. He heard crashing sounds, furniture, maybe bodies, and the noise of something that didn't sound like conversation. When he finally looked back, he saw Combs walking away and Cassie sitting silently, with visible swelling on her forehead and around one eye. Kaplan didn't call anyone. He didn't ask questions. He didn't even offer an ice pack. He just kept his head down. That decision, or the inability to make a different one, hovered over his entire testimony. When asked why he didn't report the assault, Kaplan explained that at the time he felt trapped. He described Combs as a god among men and said he idolized him. The job was too big. The world was too powerful. And more importantly, the system around Combs didn't allow for dissent. Everyone knew what they were supposed to do, and even more importantly, what they weren't. Robin Drake, the retired FBI behavioral expert analyzing these proceedings, said this kind of psychological environment isn't all that rare in counterintelligence or organized coercion. You build a bubble around a central figure, remove accountability, and reward silence with proximity to power. Over time, the people inside that bubble stop questioning the morality of what they're witnessing. They start justifying it or ignoring it altogether. Kaplan didn't just describe events, he described a culture, one where fear didn't always come from direct threats, but from knowing what stepping out of line could cost. That same fear was echoed later in the day when Myla Morales took the stand. Morales wasn't an assistant or an employee of Diddy. She was Cassie's makeup artist and had been for years. In early 2010, during Grammy's weekend, Morales and Cassie were sharing a suite at the Beverly Hills Hotel when everything changed. Morales told the court that she was in the room when Combs burst in unannounced, screaming, asking where Cassie was. She recalled him tearing through the suite, enraged. Cassie had been napping in the bedroom. Morales didn't go into what happened behind the closed door, but she did describe what she saw afterward. Cassie came out of that room with a swollen eye, a busted lip, and what she described as knots on her head. She was disoriented, shaken, and clearly in pain. Morales said she immediately took her away from the hotel and brought her home to recover. For the next few days, she hid Cassie from the public eye. A doctor friend of hers offered to examine her and recommended Cassie go to the hospital. Cassie refused, and Morales didn't call the police. So when asked why, Morales said she was scared of Combs, scared of what he might do, and just as importantly, scared of what might happen to her own life if she stepped into that storm. Her loyalty, her safety, and her silence had all been co-opted by fear. It wasn't just the violence that left a mark. It was the knowledge that nothing would be done about it, that no one would stop it, and that those who tried would be cast out of the system. Drake often talks about this kind of psychological infrastructure as internalized threat conditioning. You don't need someone to threaten you directly if they've already conditioned you to fear the consequences of stepping out of line. Neither Kaplan nor Morales presented themselves as victims in the traditional sense, but their stories painted a disturbing picture of what it means to be orbiting someone powerful, someone allegedly capable of operating above consequence. They weren't dragged into anything. They walked in, fully aware of the perks, but once inside, they said, the exit signs disappeared. And it's this system, this invisible scaffolding around a celebrity empire that now sits under a spotlight. These aren't just stories about a man who allegedly committed acts of violence. These are stories about the people who stood nearby, who knew, who stayed silent, and who now, years later, are testifying because the silence finally became heavier than the risk. What makes their testimony so important isn't just the content, it's the context. These are people who had access, not strangers, not gossipers, assistants, stylists, the people you don't think twice about, but who see everything. The ones backstage in the cars, on the flights. If Kid Cudi showed us how retaliation could be delivered in fire and silence, Kaplan and Morales showed us how it could be buried in loyalty and fear. In the end, what they described wasn't a man out of control. It was a man in control of everything, allegedly. And more importantly, it was a system that enabled it. A culture that required people not to care, not to ask, not to act. Because if you did, you might lose access, you might lose protection, or you might become the next target. As their testimony wrapped and the court prepared for what's next, it became clear that this case isn't just about the alleged acts of Sean Combs. It's about the infrastructure that allowed those acts to occur and continue. And it's about the people who, for a long time, kept the machine running.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.